A few things from one of Montana's leading economists, Dr. Patrick Barkey, past director of the BBER, mortgage rates, debt. That's another thing here as well. Well, he does our Economic Minute as well, and there's an interesting one about the cost of the Endangered Species Act and the economy. And then just chatting, what is the real shape of our economy? I think we have some anxiety in certain places, but we certainly seem to be moving forward. Dr. Patrick Barkey on the program here today on Voices. As I read and kind of understand some things, everybody's starting to, you know, hop in the same boat about debt, living with debt and paying off debt. I think this year we actually paid more interest on our national debt than we did for defense spending. And when you get to that point, there should be some alarms going off, some bells going off there, right? About our national debt. And how does that impact interest rates? The Fed Reserve, how are they doing? Let's ask Dr. Patrick Barkey to come on and explain all these things in the world to us. Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Good morning, Tom. I'm not sure who you're talking about, but I guess you got me.
Yeah. No, that's you. Got to get some explaining going on here. How you been, Patrick? You came back from overseas. I know we didn't talk about that leading into it, but how was that?
Yeah, I took a little trip over to England for a while, and it was warm. I'll say that. England is an interesting economy. The UK, it's sort of it's halfway between Europe and the US. They have a lot of issues there that we also have, but they're just arriving faster because they're a smaller economy. And so you mentioned debt in your intro, and they're plagued with debt, as are many countries in Europe. But the creditors are a little less forgiving when the economy is growing a little more slowly, and it's a lot slower. So they're under a lot of pressure right now to do something about it, and it remains to be seen what they're going to do.
You know, one of the things, I heard in one of your Economic Minutes about our global debt problem here as well, and the Feds can only do so much. And I think we've talked about this in the past. There's only so many bullets, so to speak, that they have in their holster to affect that. And they do not control the global credit markets. I'm seeing China. China thinks that it, for me, is a mixed bag because they're accumulating debt, but they're also issuing, and buying debt. So overall, where are we headed with, and is there a trend? And, you know, it seems to me like trends like this don't end well. What do you see?
Well, what I see is what every Montanan sees right now, and that is our mailbox is stuffed with printed cards with nice, shining, smiling candidates promising all kinds of things. And what I see, quite frankly, Tom, is more of the same. I like all these people running for office. I'm not going to pick winners and losers by any means, but not a single one of them is saying they're going to do anything about the debt. They're all signing up saying, hey, we're going to make government smaller. We're going to no new taxes and all these sorts of things that you say. And we've been saying for years and years and years, and not a single one is saying it's time to hold the line. I'm sitting here in Missoula County right now, and our county commissioners just said, well, you know, we need to raise property taxes 3.5% because, you know, we have increased expenses. So, of course, that's what we got to do. That doesn't really factor into the debt question, by the way. I realize that. But this is just part of the general business as usual in government. We don't, and I say you and I, I'm not saying it's other people, but we have consistently ignored the debt. And that is not just people, not through our words, but through our actions. We reward those who promise to give us things, and we punish those who dare to mention the fact that, we're running out of money.
Yeah.
So, what do you get?
Who do we owe this debt to? So to speak. I mean, I know it's not an easy answer, but who do we owe the debt to?
Well, there's sovereign debt and there's individual debt. I'll tell you what, I'll just give you one example. Most of these very large investment funds own a good chunk of U.S. treasuries. In fact, that is kind of a default place to dump money as people are working and they're devoting part of their paychecks to their investment plans, and these companies manage it. As you're talking about giant sums of money. These go into treasuries in many cases, not in total, of course, but you know, for a lot of reasons, you know, they're considered to be pretty safe places to bank money. They earn a return. It's a better return. And so there are a lot of people. Some of them are businesses, some of them are governments, but some of them are people, some of them are rich, some of them are poor, and they're savers. They're savers because they know they're going to retire someday or whatever the reasons are. And treasuries are a place where they go. You mentioned the debt clock. To me, what's a lot scarier than a clock going by telling us how much money we owe is the fact that the U.S. Treasury has to sell billions of dollars of new debt every single day just to keep things running. So imagine, you know, you open up a window and you say, hey, we're open for business. Who wants to give us money? All right. And it can be a daunting job sometimes. And there's some special things to talk about right now. But to me, the story of the debt as well is how broad it is. I mean, the headline just came out about how the U.S. is going to help the Japanese prop up their currency, the yen, which has been incredibly weak. And one of the reasons why we're doing that is because we don't want the Japanese to sell off their treasury bond holdings in order to prop up their own currency. The Japanese are actually going to borrow from the Fed, which is incredible. And why are they doing that? Well, because the U.S. doesn't want to see a lot of people selling treasury notes, because that'll bid up the price and make all the borrowing costs more expensive for us. Mm. So the debt story has a lot of legs. You mentioned defense spending, interest payments, all those things are true. But what's unchanged is what's printed on those cards that are arriving in my mailbox from politicians, some of whom I like and admire. But the kind of things they're saying, it just indicates that we're going to get more of the same.
Well, and then you see, you know, the rash end of that, where you've got Mamdani in New York, and you know he's trying to initiate government-funded everything, you know, marketplaces, housing, and those, you know, and there's a price for all of that. And again, that's a bit of a mess in a lot of ways. I'm gonna come back and talk about how do we retire this debt? Do we retire this debt? I don't know if there's a process, and I'm, again, you're the guy with all the answers. So give us one here.
I'll do my best.
Thank you. So how do we retire this debt? Do we retire this debt?
Okay. Yeah. I thought you were going to break. We already have retired debt. I mean, we ran a period in the 90s when, we ran a surplus, and it's kind of hard to believe, but when George W. first got elected, there was a fear, if you will, or at least the thought that we might actually pay off this debt. We keep running these surpluses, you know, this kind of thing. Didn't last long.
No.
How did it happen? Well, it happened because there was a big decline in spending on defense, and there was a big, there's a lot of healthy tax revenues coming in because the economy was doing well, inflation was low, and we had strong growth. So, I guess what I'm saying is that we retired debt through things that were automatic and through things that reflected more good fortune than they did policy. So we didn't, for example, abolish departments and government. We didn't make conscious decisions to shrink government, increase tax base, whatever the kinds of things you would do. But they were things of fortune. And some people think that, that ultimately is, if not the solution, it's a super important part of the solution, because throughout all this debt talk, there has been, good growth in the economy and so forth. One So I think that's historically how it's happened, Tom. And, of course, you can't count on that, and it's been very infrequent. What we've seen are a million different mechanisms to increase the debt.
Yeah.
So they range from phony emergencies, the complete ignoring all of the restraints on government, the so-called 10-year budget rules that were supposed to constrain government spending, require there to be enough revenue set aside to pay for increases. All those things have been subverted by Congress, which is extremely talented at doing that kind of thing, passing rules and then finding ways around them. So I guess my first answer in terms of what conscious policies could be taken to retire debt would be that the item number one would be to stop going in the other direction. Just that.
Yeah, stop digging that hole when you find yourself
exactly.
in it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, have a little bit of discipline, not a little bit, but a whole lot of discipline to not necessarily retire debt, but my gosh, we're running $2 trillion a year peacetime deficits.
Yeah.
That's and everyone likes it. The return rate of people in Congress is super high. There's no outrage in the general public for these kinds of things. Whenever people talk about what the issues are and upcoming elections, debt is never on the list. That's going to be swimming upstream, politically speaking. But nonetheless, that would be item number one on my list.
And definitely something that we should put on our plates when politicians do come knocking. Dr. Patrick Barkey is with us again, economist. He does our Economic Minute for the Northern Broadcasting System. You can catch that on many of your affiliates across the state of Montana. Hello to them in Lewistown, KXLO, 1230 AM. This would be a good one for you as well. I've got a breakup coming here, but I want to just one final question about this debt. We're seeing a lot of fraud being revealed here. $90 billion in Minnesota. The fast track train to nowhere, California, Washington state. It does kind of pinpoint to a lot of blue states. U.S. aid is how much of this debt is part of that, and will, I know it'll help in some measure, but will it help in any good measure to kind of curtail this corruption, so to speak?
Well, I'm going to give you a little bit of a contrarian kind of answer to that, okay? Mm-hmm. Because I'm as outraged by some of these stories as anybody else. But historically speaking, what has happened in government spending is that there are cases of fraud exposed, and as a result, people are elected who promise to get tough on this kind of thing. And they passed lots and lots of new rules, and that's where red tape comes from, okay? Red tape comes from lots of rules, lots of regs, lots of safeguards, and so forth, that make what we spend money on much less efficient. That's part of my contrary answer. It's not that fighting fraud is a bad thing. It's just you have to understand it's not totally good either. There are some nasty things that come out of trying to crack down on X, Y, and Z, be it people collecting Medicaid that shouldn't get it. I mean, all these kinds of things, and that's the history. So very few people recognize that. But the second thing I would say is that when you run the numbers, even though the fraud numbers are staggeringly large, they're not nearly as large as the automatic built-in month by month overspending that takes place across the board, especially on entitlements in the economy. And it's not that we simply need to cut these kinds of things. It's just that we need to be a little bit more sensible about how we're reaching the goals that many of these very large programs are all about.
Yeah.
So we don't do that. I think it's going to end well, Tom, and I don't really know how or when it's going to end, but I do know it has to.
A note here, we'll be talking about energy with Dr. Patrick Barkey, our guest today, as we go over Montana's and the world's economy. on Thursday, we'll be over in Colstrip at the Colstrip Open to do a live show there. It's essentially what it is. It's a meeting of energy officials over there in Colstrip, put on by the Development Corporation there and Jim Acheson. And really, we'll be Grid United will be there. We'll chat with them about, as we get ready to talk about that here too, America's infrastructure and our grid infrastructure. We'll talk about AI as well. It's on everybody's minds. And as we're talking about energy, you can't talk about the future of energy without having a place for AI. And there are a lot of concerns regarding that, too, from the public standpoint. Let's get into that here. But that's on Thursday's show, program, live from the Colstrip Open. We'll get right into it in great detail. Patrick Barkey and Dr. Barkey, I appreciate your coming on. Again, former director of the BBER, one of Montana's leading economists as well, and does our economic minute. Power Grid, Grid United's coming. That's like a boutique. And that is, I think, interesting in and of itself, in that this is a group that said, I see this infrastructure need, and it must have cost, millions and millions and millions of dollars even to have a thought regarding pulling that off. But they are getting it pulled off. What do you think about that?
Well, they're joining a large movement. I mean, one of the things that's really moving the needle on the entire economy has been the everything AI, but especially on the infrastructure side. Mm-hmm. So we've had these phenomenally successful tech companies in the economy, largely outside of Montana, as business players. Obviously, we use the tech here in Montana. And they're sitting on amounts of money that are so large none of us can comprehend it, but they're spending, and they're borrowing and spending, and the spending that's occurring across the country is just incredible. So I mean, the Grid United reflects that. I mean, if they build that, they will have customers. There's no question about it. There's reasons why Montana is attractive. It doesn't seem that way right now as we sit here in early August, but it's a cooler climate. It represents a geographic diversity, so that if some event happens in northern Virginia where all these data centers already are right now, you've got something somewhere else mm-hmm. that is hopefully not affected by that. So it's a success story, but it's also a big risk in the sense that any business investment is a risk, and that none of us know exactly how this is all going to play out, but people are certainly making some very big bets on this.
And I should explain, Grid United is a company that is putting up distribution lines that essentially is going to connect Eastern and Western energy suppliers, kind of for the first time. It's a really advanced power grid that's going to be kind of located from that Colstrip area, but then head west or east, I should say. And a lot of that, again, it's private. You see Northwestern Energy, Montana Power, they generally own their transmission and distribution, but Grid United is just going to be, as I call it, a boutique. But specializing in just that distribution. And so kind of unique for us, I think, in that regard. Energy, are we going to get on top of our energy needs?
Well, there's some very, very simple things you could say about energy that unfortunately not enough people are saying. But the first thing to be said is that the era of stagnant electricity demand is over.
Mm. Yeah,
it's been something that's been around for a considerable period of time. It goes almost back to the 80s. There was a lot of overbuilding in the 70s and the 80s. Colstrip might have been part of that. I mean, I'm not going to point any fingers or anything, but gave us a lot of spare capacity, particularly here in Pacific Northwest where we had so much hydro. There were efficiency gains, deindustrialization, the aluminum plants packed up and left, et cetera. And there's not much left there to really keep electricity demand in check. I mean, everything else in the economy is growing. I mean, the numbers are amazing. So that's the first thing to be said. The second thing to be said is that the investments that you need to make in growing the grid are long-term investments. So they last decades and decades. You mentioned Grid United, and I apologize, I took off on AI there, and I wasn't even talking about the line there, but you put it very, very well, so there's no need for me to repeat what you said. But those last a very long time. They cost a lot of money. And so they're expensive, all right? And expensive things, we pay for them largely through the regulated utility system. Here's a situation where a private investor is carrying it out for a pretty good reason.
Yeah.
Because they see the potential for accommodating and serving the growth that everybody knows is right ahead. So those are just a couple of things. I think the notion that we can just simply bully back and complain about and somehow restrain the fact that costs need to be paid for through rates, by the way. Users of electricity pay for electricity. That's the way it works. But the notion that we can somehow, just sort of, I don't know what the word is, jawbone our way to keeping rates in check despite all this infrastructure being thrown up is fanciful. It's just a reality that we can't deny, and it's happening all around us.
From an economic standpoint, I got a minute left here. I'm going to throw this one on there because it relates about a lot of these data centers are saying they're going to bring their own power. Economically, can they do that, and will it be enough power?
Well, it won't be enough to start with, that's for sure. I mean, I think a lot of these plans are being, the brakes are being put on them in some places, especially because those power needs are not satisfied by what's there or what can conceivably be built in the very, very near future. But, I think that the so-called behind-the-meter investment and power is something that's it's going to happen, and it has to happen because it's just simply the profit potential, the business potential of expanding AI is the motor that's really going to kick this whole process into gear and get some of these investments going.
We'll put something on the plate that will kick things into gears as well. We'll talk about a cashless society next. A lot of population growth in Montana since 2020, since COVID. That does continue. How does that affect our housing markets? We'll talk about that. Dr. Patrick Barkey is with us here. As we also look at this, U.S. economy produces roughly one quarter of all global economic output, despite having only 4% of the world's population, and we're the world's highest incoming consumer economy. That's a large part is consumerism of our economy, maybe perhaps a little bit too large, 65%, so full two-thirds of it as well. And you look at America's economy overall, our nominal GDP, about our gross domestic product, is upwards of about $30 trillion. China's next at around $20 trillion, give or take, right? The next closest is a group. It's Japan and it's Germany, they're like at 12 to 13 million. So these economies are really, really super large. So there's a lot of things you do to kind of try and protect these economies, and that's where I think we've seen with COVID and recent inflation that kind of hangs on here as well. Dr. Patrick Barkey with us, a former BBER director, does our Economic Minute, one of Montana's leading economists. I'm going to tease. I teased cashless society, but we'll get back to Montana's economy here and overall in just a bit. But Patrick, thanks for coming on. I appreciate that. When we talk about a cashless society, I don't know if I can really fathom it, but the things that I do fathom I don't like. That is not being able to pay a neighbor kid to mow my lawn or not having the freedom to maybe even loan money to family members without that being recorded somewhere and then likely taxed or whatever. As an economist, a cashless society, Can it work? How would it work? And if it's trouble, how do we avoid it?
Well, it's already working. I mean, it's working for most Americans. I would argue even most Montanans. I mean, you know, I mean, every time you go to the gas pump, I mean, I'm not saying everyone's in the same boat, but when you look at the use of different, how do people pay for things? You know, I guess would be the one way to put it. And let's just look at retail. I mean, cash, currency, paper dollar bills and coins and so forth make up, I would say 11 or 12% of all the transactions. And then you have a whole pile of other things. You have debit cards, which are very much like cash and the way they work. And then, of course, you have credit cards and you have other means of paying for things that have a giant share. So I think it's something that is not new. I mean, it's certainly the way we pay for things with our non-cash assets has changed. But I'm just sticking with dollars here. I'm not even going to talk about stable coins and bitcoins, all that sort of thing. In terms of it being recorded, well, yes. I mean, it's amazing. My wife hates it, and I and most Americans are more or less fatalistic about it. In that everything we do, every time we buy anything online and so forth, there's records, there's data, and that data has value. And companies have made a lot of money exploiting the information value of all that sort of thing. So that's. That's just describing reality. I mean, that's not, so when you ask, could it work? It works quite well. We were chatting a little bit earlier about how, about my own, I mean, I happened to have made a trip to England, and we were at a place that they called it a resort. It makes it sound really fancy. It wasn't all that fancy, but they told us all, in advance, no cash. So I went to England and how many pounds should I bring with me, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously the currency. I brought zero, all right? I actually had a few coins that were left over from an earlier trip, but I didn't use any. Now how is that paid for? That's another question, you know? I mean, it's obviously, it's reflected somehow. There's a whole apparatus, a whole infrastructure to make that happen. By and large, that ultimately comes down to merchants and customers that pay for that. And we get the convenience, and there's subtle ways in which we all pay for it that are not totally obvious. I actually wrote a couple podcasts about that.
There's a dark side to this, though, as well, when people talk about personal freedom, and then also having access to your own wealth, so to speak. If it's a cashless society, you're going to have protections over it. So here comes the tax man, and here comes the regulation guy as well. And there's a necessity for that as well. But this whole dark side to a cashless society, I can't really escape. What are your thoughts?
Well, it depends on how you define dark, right? Mm-hmm. There's dark from the point of view of the government and the regulator, and there's dark from your point of view. We are a country, like some of the other major industrialized countries, where the huge preponderance of economic activity takes place in the sunshine, where people can see it, it's recorded, it's reported to government, you pay taxes on it, you do things according to the regulations. Depending on what they are, whether they're money laundering laws or whatever it is, okay? There are other countries you go to where most of the economic activity is black market. So everything's off the books. You're paid for jobs off the books and so forth. So there's that definition of dark, right? I mean, dark from the point of view of government. I'm not going to say which is better or which is worse, but I'll just say that the more prosperous countries have more of their economic activity in the daylight, so to speak. Mm-hmm. All right, so it's officially recorded and it's accounted for and so forth. Now, I'm not sure what else you mean by dark there. You mean in terms of
not letting me spend my money, make you know, having control over it, where if they want, you know, they're not going to make me pay taxes. They'll just take it out of my money, so to speak, which they kind of do anyway, I know. But I guess it's that darker side, that you're giving up freedom and you're giving up control over something that, you know, guides your future, and the future of your families. And you, I'm not a friend of government. I think that they get larger and larger and bigger and bigger, and the bigger they are, the meaner they get, I guess, if I can just speak simply so.
Yeah, well, I think tax collectors are about as mean as they get, right? But that's the reality. I mean, each of us surrenders some part of our freedom, you know, every day. You know, I mean, I don't have the freedom to drive on whichever side of the road I want to drive on. You know, and I don't have any freedom to. I remember that. And this has probably happened in Montana as well, but when I lived in another state ages ago, there was a tax freedom movement that was basically said, hey, we shouldn't pay taxes anymore. And they spread information about how not have withholding taken out of your paycheck, typically by claiming, you know, 99 deductions or something like that. That was cast in exactly the kind of language you've just used. In other words, this was freedom. This was removing the yoke of government and so forth. Mm-hmm. But it was also against the law. And you know, the government has they have guns and they're legally entitled to use them. And ultimately, that's why we pay taxes. That's why we do these things, because. You know, because there is enforcement. There's consequences for flouting the law, even if you you know, you can get away with it for a while. So I'm not sure how we got onto that exact variant of this conversation, but the cashless society is not really cashless. I mean, it's still based on the dollar. There still are pennies in circulation, even if they're not being made anymore. But you know, in terms of the way transactions actually happen. They happen through computers talking to each other and moving ledgers around from one side of the table to another.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. Like you said earlier, we're somewhat fatalistic about it, but we still have an ability to determine our future when it comes to, you know, this aspect of our economy. As I mentioned, Thursday we'll be at the Colstrip Open Live, 4:06 in a bit. We'll talk more about some of these things we're hitting on here, energy, our power grid, affordability of these kinds of things going forward. And then open phones for tomorrow and upcoming also the BBER, which Dr. Patrick Barkey, our guest today, used to head for a number of years, is out with their Midsummer Economic Outlook Series, AI is their topic, and data. And so we'll have Jeffrey Michaels, who's now the new head of that, took over Patrick a little while ago on the program, either Friday or Monday early of next week. Patrick, thank you again for coming on. Appreciate that. I enjoyed listening. And I got a peek, you guys. Some of these economic minutes, they'll air as we go forward from here as well as we're talking about. And hopefully you're catching them in Glendive or in Hamilton. If not, call your local affiliate there too. But I wanted to hit Montana's economy a little bit, or even this overall economy. You know, I know we're struggling with affordability. That's because they just flooded, I think, our economy with feel good money during the COVID. President Trump wanted to do it before he left office. President Biden did it immediately when he got into office. Those things, I think, really hit to it. I'm anxious about it. I don't know that we've got solid footing for our economy here in Montana and elsewhere. Maybe Montana's different. It seems a little more solid here in this state than it does globally.
That's perhaps true. I mean, you can't argue with low unemployment rates. I mean, they're certainly telling you something. There's a lot of anxiety about a lot of things, but it's not mass layoffs. It's like you say, it's affordability, and affordability is most immediately affected by what's going on with prices and inflation. And that's certainly a cause that makes people very anxious about about what's going on in Semi captivity. In terms of what's happening in Montana, we're kind of moving sideways. There's a lot of promising things going on in some different parts of the state. Lots of really promising announcements and great calls, and of course, what's happening in Lewistown. You mentioned some of the stuff happening with Big United. there's not a lot of growth in some of the things you mentioned. I kind of raised my eyebrow a little bit about, and that's population growth, because population growth is really back to where it was pre-COVID. I mean, that accelerating trend kind of burned itself out. I think there's some new concerns with respect to what's going on with tourism, particularly international tourism, is not having a great year, is my feeling, although we don't have the data yet. But I think it's been a reasonably good year. It's still Montana still benefits, the core industries and agriculture and certainly mining and natural resources. Are pretty solid. This administration has been a little bit more friendly towards some of that activity. The rest of the stuff is really, it's too soon to know, quite frankly, how it all adds up. But like I say, I think people are a little anxious because of things that are outside their control, and that's mostly on prices. Montanans are benefiting from the booming capital markets just like everyone else. I mean, the increase in household net worth is happening in Montana just as it is every place else. It's helping people feel a little bit better about making bigger ticket spending if they choose to do that. But they're concerned because the kinds of things they're spending money on, particularly regarding housing we mentioned, are so much more pricey that their dollars just don't go as far.
I wish we had a little more time for a quick lightning round, because I did pick up on some of these upcoming economic minutes as well. There's some key statements there I'd like to float around, but I'll just throw them out there. New debt is pricier. And so we kind of talked about it a little bit, mortgage rates. Everybody's selling debt into a pretty tough market. You noted, buying housing as an investment when you talked about Flint, Michigan. That's a trend we're seeing in Montana. You also noted that U.S. wealth creation is actually kind of ahead of the rest, and you noted our digital economic growth productivity in that regard too. So, hey Patrick, any 15 second final thoughts for us? Kind of like hang on.
It's mostly good news. I mean, despite the fact you talked about a lot of things to worry about, the fundamentals in the economy remain pretty good. And I'm pretty bullish about where we're going.
Good to hear that. It really is. It does help me with that level of anxiety I have going on regarding our economy. Patrick, thank you. I'm glad you got away, and I'm glad you're still feeding us through the economic minutes. Good job, sir.
All right, Tom. Always great to be on your program. Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.